You are listening to a sermon by Kevin Hebert, recorded on Sunday, August 1st, 2010, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org. So, who wants to hear the story of a guy who stays true to his faith despite suffering severe losses? Well, this morning I'm not going to tell the story about the actor Stephen Baldwin, brother to Alec and Billy Baldwin, who went bankrupt to the tune of a couple of million dollars after becoming a Christian and continuing to live a Hollywood lifestyle while turning down film and TV roles that had gratuitous sex and violence. If you want to hear Stephen's story, you'll have to go to allthatknowhim.org and listen to the fundraising video and learn about the donation collecting site apparently started by Daniel Southern, Stephen's spiritual advisor, and Billy Graham's crusade director for almost 20 years. Anyway, the book of Job tells the story of a real hero of faith, likely set during the general time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, around 2000 to 1800 BC. In a region possibly southeast of Palestine. The exact date and authorship of the book isn't known. It could have been written by Job himself, or Moses, or the scribes of Solomon in 950 BC, the golden age of biblical wisdom literature, or a writer as late as 200 BC even. But there were other works of ancient wisdom literature in the ancient Near East during the second millennium BC that dealt with similar themes but did not contemplate the idea of a righteous sufferer. One was a Sumerian work entitled Man and His God, and another was an Akkadian monologue entitled I Will Praise the Lord of Wisdom. According to a minister in Kentucky, the English name Job is actually the equivalent of IWB in capital letters, in Hebrew, meaning like Job, the persecuted one, or come back and repent, depending on the translation. The Book of Job is an ancient treatise on the problem of pain, as in the title of the C.S. Lewis book, also known as Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? That is, if God is good, loving, and all-powerful, then why does God allow evil and suffering to exist? Another label for this conundrum is the problem of evil. And the literary form is called theodicy, which comes from the Greek theos, or God, and dicy, justice. The term was coined in 1710 by the German philosopher Gottfried Leibniz in a work in French entitled Theodicy Essays on the Goodness of God, the Freedom of Man, and the Origin of Evil. More than simply a defense which attempts to show that there is no logical incompatibility between the existence of evil and the existence of God, a theodicy is a more ambitious attempt to provide a plausible justification for the existence of evil. You heard the story of Job read in the New Revised Standard Version, but I'll retell it from Peterson's The Message paraphrase to really make the point that it is an accessible work of literature with profound concepts for us to ponder as a community whose members and neighbors suffer and look for God in tragic circumstances. Job chapter 1, verses 1 to 5, introduces Job and his family as genuinely righteous, materially blessed, and very hospitable. It goes like this. Job was a man who lived in Uz. He was honest inside and out, a man of his word, who was totally devoted to God and hated evil with a passion. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. He was also very wealthy, 7,000 head of sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 teams of oxen, 500 donkeys, and a huge staff of servants, the most influential man in the East. His sons used to take turns hosting parties in their homes, always inviting their 3 sisters to join them in the merrymaking. When the parties were over, Job would get up early in the morning and sacrifice a burnt offering for each of his children, thinking, maybe one of them sinned by defying God inwardly. Job made a habit of this sacrificial atonement, just in case they'd sinned. To get a sense of just how wealthy Job was in that era, I looked up the current prices of livestock available for sale in the Third World from Oxfam. $75 per sheep, $125 per camel, $300 per ox, and a team of oxen would have been 2 ox, and $100 per donkey. and multiplied those admittedly conservative rates by the quantity of each type of animal listed in chapter 1, verse 3, to calculate the cash value of the herds as at least $1.25 million in today's money. That much working capital invested in inventory, multiplied by standard turnover ratios and evidence of a large staff, suggests an impressive agribusiness owned by the Job family. Although you might assume that Job's family lived in modest huts, archaeological discoveries from the same era at the nearby Ur of the Chaldees in Mesopotamia, near modern Basra in Iraq, have uncovered wealthy citizens living in large two-storied villas of more than 12 rooms each. The walls were neatly coated with plaster and whitewashed. In the entrance hall would be a wash basin, and around an inner courtyard would be a reception room, kitchen, living rooms, and an in-house chapel. The lavatory was concealed beneath a stone staircase, and upstairs were the bedrooms. Job was so concerned that God would be pleased with his family that he made sacrifices on behalf of his children, even for their thought crimes. Quite an impressive concept that even Jesus had to explain to his disciples about how lust without adultery is still a sin. Job's sons treat their sisters with respect and inclusion, and Job's honesty, devotion to God, and righteousness, hating evil, are highlighted by the narrator, so that when trouble comes later in the book, we should know better than to jump to conclusions about Job deserving punishment for anything. Job chapter 1, verses 6 to 12, is all about the first conspiracy made in heaven. Satan accuses Job of being a fair-weather follower of God, and God says, "Oh yeah, prove it." Goes like this. One day when the angels came to report to God, Satan, who was the designated accuser, came along with them. God singled out Satan and said, "What have you been up to?" Satan answered God, "Going here, going there, checking out things on earth." God said to Satan, "Have you noticed my friend Job? There's no one quite like him. Honest and true to his word, totally devoted to God and hating evil." Satan retorted, "So you do think Job does all that out of the sheer goodness of his heart? Why, no one ever had it so good. You pamper him like a pet, making sure nothing bad ever happens to him or his family or his possessions. Bless everything he does. He can't lose. But what do you think would happen if you reached down and took away everything that is his? He'd curse you right to your face, that's what." God replied, "We'll see. Go ahead. Do what you want with all that is his. Just don't hurt him." Then Satan left the presence of God. I read a book by my favorite sci-fi author, Robert A. Heinlein, entitled Job, A Comedy of Justice. Written in 1984, it tells the fanciful tale of a church minister who goes on an alternate reality trip, much like an Alice in Wonderland jaunt, and gets the chance to debate theology with both Yahweh and Lucifer, portrayed as equal brothers under a supreme entity called the Chairman. Heinlein's novel seems like a critique of our Judeo-Christian form of modified dualism, which argues that the powers of good and evil are unequal, with the evil power, Satan, being temporarily tolerated by the good power, God, who may use it as a mechanism for eventual good. Heinlein's character, Alex, said, "The logical reconciliation of omnipotence, omniscience, and omnibenevolence is the thorniest problem in theology, one causing even Jesuits to break their teeth." Omnipotence means all-powerful. If God can do anything, why doesn't he stop bad things from happening to good people? Shouldn't he be rewarding positive behaviors and attitudes? Omniscience means all-knowing. If God sees and hears everything and knows our innermost thoughts, why doesn't he at least warn us before we do something stupid or an external force attacks us so that we can better protect ourselves? Omnibenevolence is all-good. Why would God allow Satan or the natural world to cause any harm to Job or to us? Isn't he an accessory to the damage by even passively permitting it? Will these questions be answered in the book of Job? Let's find out. Job chapter 1, verses 13 to 22 is the first test. Job loses his family and his fortune. It goes like this. Sometime later, while Job's children were having one of their parties at the home of the oldest son, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys grazing in the field next to us when Sabaeans attacked. They stole the animals and killed the field hands. I'm the only one to get out alive and tell you what happened." While he was still talking, another messenger arrived and said, "Bolts of lightning struck the sheep and the shepherds and fried them, burnt them to a crisp. I'm the only one to get out alive and tell you what happened. While he was still talking, another messenger arrived and said, Chaldeans coming from three directions raided the camels and massacred the camel drivers. I'm the only one to get out alive and tell you what happened. And while he was still talking, another messenger arrived and said, Your children are having a party at the home of the oldest brother when a tornado swept off the desert and struck the house. It collapsed on the young people and they died. I'm the only one to get out alive and tell you what happened. Job got to his feet, ripped his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground and worshipped. Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I'll return to the womb of the earth. God gives, God takes, God's name ever be blessed. Not once through all this did Job sin, not once did he blame God. Well, what a perfect storm of disaster. The Sabaeans who made off with the livestock were the inhabitants of the ancient kingdom of Sheba in southeastern Arabia. The Chaldeans mentioned here are actually a group of regional nomadic marauders, not the ones from Ur that I talked about earlier. The saying goes that lightning never strikes twice, so it seems implausible that all the sheep and every sheep herder could be killed by lightning at once. But University of Arizona atmospheric scientists recently confirmed that cloud-to-ground lightning commonly strikes the ground in two or more places. Lightning is one of the biggest weather-related killers, topped only by heat and flooding. The villas of that time had a main floor built solidly of burnt brick, but the upper floor was made of mud brick. So it makes sense that a tornado could cause the weaker upper structures to collapse onto the occupants below. But for all of those disasters and attacks to happen simultaneously, quote, while he, each messenger, was still talking, unquote, that is a statistical improbability which shows that it was used to describe a supernatural intervention. So the point is that God allowed natural disasters and the greed of men to be focused on Job to strip him of his wealth and his offspring. While Job understandably laments his losses, he is recognized for the way he humbly accepted that he wasn't entitled to permanently keep the blessings that he had accumulated. He worshipped God anyway and passed the first test by resisting the temptation to blame God. In Job chapter 2, verses 1 to 6, the second conspiracy is made in heaven. Satan says Job will crack if tortured. God says, good luck trying. It goes like this. One day, when the angels came to report to God, Satan also showed up. God singled out Satan, saying, And what have you been up to? Satan said, answered God, Oh, going here and going there, checking things out. Then God said to Satan, Have you noticed my friend Job? There's no one quite like him. Is there honest and true to his word, totally devoted to God and hating evil? He still has a firm grip on his integrity. You tried to trick me into destroying him, but it didn't work. Satan answered, A human would do anything to save his life. But what do you think would happen if you reached down and took away his health? He'd curse you to your face, that's what. God said, All right, go ahead. You can do with him as you like. But mind you, don't kill him. Did you catch that part where God recognized that Satan tried to trick him into destroying Job, testing Job beyond his limit to endure? It sounds like God issued an executive order authorizing torture in extreme circumstances. In The Problem of Pain, C.S. Lewis explored how God in his mysterious wisdom may choose to transform the consequences of evil into a redemptive purpose, making lemons into lemonade, so to speak. C.S. Lewis writes, In the fallen and partially redeemed universe, we may distinguish, 1, the simple good descending from God, 2, simple evil produced by rebellious creatures, and 3, the exploitation of that evil by God for his redemptive purpose, which produces 4, the complex good to which accepted suffering and repented sin contribute. A merciful man aims at his neighbor's good, as so does God's will, consciously cooperating with the simple good. A cruel man oppresses his neighbor, and so does simple evil. But in doing such evil, he is used by God, without his knowledge or consent, to produce the complex good, so that the first man receives God as a son, the second as a tool. For you will certainly carry out God's purpose, however you act, but it makes a difference to you whether you serve like Judas or like John. In the recent investigations into the effectiveness of torture by the U.S. intelligence services and their allies on the war on terror, Psychologists and interrogators alike nearly unanimously agreed that abusive techniques nearly always result in a flood of bad or unverifiable information and took longer than non-coercive techniques. Maybe God allowed Job to be tortured because he knew that Job would hold true and would prove that torture doesn't work. In Job chapter 2, verses 7 to 10, the second test, Job loses his health. It goes like this. Satan left God and struck Job with terrible sores. Job was ulcers and scabs from head to foot. They itched and oozed so badly that he took a piece of broken pottery to scrape himself. He then went and sat on a trash heap among the ashes. His wife said, "Still holding on to your precious integrity, are you? Curse God and be done with it." He told her, "You're talking like an empty-headed fool. We take the good days from God. Why not also the bad days?" Not once through all this did Job sin. He said nothing against God. Well, the exact disease or medical condition causing Job's symptoms has not been determined. In later chapters, we'll hear more about his symptoms, including night terrors in chapter 7, fever, bone pain, and skin blackening in chapter 30. Notice that Job didn't actually call his wife foolish, he just said that she sounded like one. You may have heard the phrase, "Well, at least I have my health," from someone who's lost a lot of money in the stock market or real estate or in business. But the equation of whether it is worth it to be faithful changes when you're faced with the pain of injury, sickness, or the prospect of an agonizing death. When my grandfather, C.J. Remple, was dying of cancer, I remember how he told my grandma that his greatest fear was not of death itself. He looked forward to going home to be with his maker. It was that in the throes of pain, he might curse God for allowing the disease to ravage him for 10 years. But he drew on his life of daily devotions for strength to the end, a beacon of dignity and an example of perseverance to his many friends and our whole family. In Job chapter 2, verses 11 to 13, Job's three friends come to console him. It goes like this. Three of Job's friends heard all of the trouble that had fallen on him. Each traveled from his own country, Eliphaz from Teman, Bildad from Shuhah, Zophar from Naamath, and they went together to Job to keep him company and comfort him. When they first caught sight of him, they couldn't believe what they saw. They hardly recognized him. They cried out in lament, ripped their clothes, dumped dirt on their heads as a sign of their grief. They sat with him on the ground. 7 days and nights they sat there without saying a word. They could see how rotten he felt, how deeply he was suffering. Some friends distance themselves when they don't know how to deal with the intensity of our emotional responses to pain and suffering. Initially, these friends appeared to be supportive, not jumping in right away with their own theories. Yet. But let their friend express where he was at in the process of grief. The land of Teman was a southern portion of the land of Edom. Shuhah was a descendant of Caleb of Judah, and Naamath was probably on the Arabian borders of Syria. In Job chapter 3, which is verses 1 to 26, Job cries out, "What is the point of life?" Goes like this. Then Job broke the silence. He spoke up and cursed his fate. "Obliterate the day I was born. Blank out the night I was conceived. Let it be a black hole in space. May God above forget it ever happened. Erase it from the books. May the day of my birth be buried in deep darkness, shrouded by the fog, swallowed by the night. And the night of my conception, the devil take it. Rip the date off the calendar. Delete it from the almanac. Oh, turn that night into pure nothingness. No sounds of pleasure from that night ever. May those who are good at cursing curse that day. Unleash the beast, sea beast, Leviathan on it. May its morning stars turn to black cinders, waiting for the daylight that never comes, never once seeing the first light of dawn. And why? Because it released me from my mother's womb into a life with so much trouble." That is some rant. A repudiation of his birthday as a proxy for his existence. So intense that not only should the date never be celebrated, but should be erased from the history books. The Leviathan mentioned in verse 8 is also known as Rahab, the dragon monster that the pagan deity Baal was said to have killed in an ancient myth. Job knew of this myth and would have been referring to it in the same poetic way that we might refer to Santa Claus when talking about Christmas gift giving. He continues his bitter complaint by wishing that he'd been stillborn, which I'll skip over. And Job continued saying, I could be resting in peace right now, asleep forever, feeling no pain. The small and the great are equals in that place. The slaves are free from their masters. Why does God bother giving light to the miserable? Why bother keeping bitter people alive? Those who want in the worst way to die and can't. Who can't imagine anything better than death. Who count the day of their death and burial the happiest day of their life. What is the point of life when it doesn't make sense? When God blocks all roads to meaning? Instead of bread, I get groans for my supper, then leave the table and vomit my anguish. The worst of my fears has come true. What I've dreaded most has happened. My repose is shattered. My peace destroyed. No rest for me ever. Death has invaded my life. Well, since this is the first part of a four-part series, I don't have an upbeat ending to leave you with. The first three chapters of the book of Job set the stage for an in-depth examination of theodicy. One, some people are righteous and prosper, which was Job and his family at the start of the story. Two, some people are wicked and prosper, think of corrupt politicians and drug lords living large. Three, some people are wicked and suffer, convicted criminals, exposed adulterers. And four, some people are righteous and suffer, Job's experience in the rest of the story. If this was a TV series, you would hear a guttural announcer say, "Next time on the Job series, we'll hear Job arguing with Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and Elihu about the consequences of sin, Job's good works, God's justice, innocent suffering, demand for explanations, and the teaching value of affliction, all coming up next in the book of Job. And don't miss the finale in which God speaks. Stay tuned to see who gets sent packing and who gets to live happily ever after."